Hi, folks. Doug McBurney here. Keeping Bob Enyart live on the radio gives him the ability to promote godly ideas on the terrestrial airwaves. I'm asking you to go online to purchase any or all of Bob's eye-opening Christian resources available in written, audio, or video formats. Go to kgov.com and come alongside Bob's vital ministry and keep Bob broadcasting on the radio. That's kgov.com, kgov.com right now, to give Bob the essential support that only you can offer.
Warning, this truth of a head. It gets beyond all the headlines you read. Don't need lip service with a wink and a nod. You need a man on a mission from God. Well, not to worry, here's Bob Enyart Live.
Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. I am Bob Enyart, the pastor of Denver Bible Church. This is Theology Thursday. Typically, we look at the news of the day from a Christian worldview. Today, we look at the source of the Christian worldview, God's Word.
How many miracles does the Bible record in the first 1,000 years of human history? In the first 1,000 years from when God created Adam and Eve, from that moment on to Enoch? Not one. From the moment, let's say from the moment Adam and Eve leave the garden until Enoch, the Bible doesn't record a single miracle. From Enoch's translation into heaven until God summoned the animals to the ark, how many miracles do we read about? And that's another 600 centuries? Not one. During the centuries that Israel suffered as slaves in Egypt, how many miracles do we read about during those centuries? Not one. However, in the brief span of the Exodus for 40 years, we count 50 separate miracles or series of miracles. So there's times of no miracles and times of relatively frequent miracles. If we charted miracles on a 1,400-year timeline from Joshua to John, we show years of inactivity, primarily, punctuated by short periods of heavy supernatural action. For example, Ehud had a miraculous victory in the book of Judges, and then 80 years pass with nothing. Years later, from Solomon's 11th year, when the cloud filled the temple, that was about 900 B.C., until God supernaturally gave Jeroboam the kingdom, about 30 years passed without a miracle, no record in the text. The Bible records only one miracle, and that wasn't very nice. That was a drought. In the 50 years from the time of Daniel surviving the lion's den up until the writing of Malachi, which was the last book of the New Testament. And then from the end of the New Testament until the beginning of the Gospels, a period of 370 years when God was silent, according to the biblical record. So today, is God doing frequent miracles, rarely doing miracles, or not at all? Well, that's the subject of another study. But Samuel chapter 3, verse 1, at this time, the word of the Lord was rare in those days, and there was no widespread revelation. And it came to pass at that time, while Eli was lying down in his place, and when his eyes had begun to grow so dim that he could not see, and before the lamp of God went out in the tabernacle of the Lord, where the ark of God was, and while Samuel was lying down, there are all these subordinate clauses here, one after another, bringing us up to a point in time where something dramatic is going to happen. But it came to pass at that time. So Eli was very old and blind. He was lying down. Just near him was Samuel. We're not sure how old he was. Tradition says he was about 12 years old at this time. And they were right near the ark. They were right near the tabernacle of the Lord. Now, the tabernacle, recall, that was in the wilderness. After the 40 years in the wilderness, then they began to move into the promised land, the land of Canaan, and they set up the tabernacle, that tent, in the town of Shiloh. And that's where it was with the Ark of the Covenant. It was there, and that's where Eli was, the priest, and young Samuel. And they said it was before the time when the lamp went out. It was before the lamp of God went out in the tabernacle. Now, what does that mean? Oh, and by the way, the tabernacle there in Shiloh, it was a tent, but at times they would call it the house of the Lord or perhaps even the temple, but it was the tent. That's what it was at that time. Okay, when they say before the lamp went out, God told the Levites to keep a fire burning on the altar of the Lord at all times. Don't let it go out. And in the morning, bring the wood for the offering, for the morning offering, and rekindle the fire on the altar, but don't let the light go out. Now, this passage, just in passing, says, and it was before the lamp of the Lord went out. I think what that means is that the priest in Shiloh were not doing their job. We saw already last week how evil they were. They rejected God. These are the priests who ministered at the tabernacle. Eli's sons, Hophni and Phinehas, who were like in charge of the worship at the tabernacle, just under their father, who was now too old to minister. And they would not offer the sacrifices the way God told them to. And when women came to bring their offerings, these priests of God would seduce the women if they could and have relations with them. These were evil men. They didn't care about the proper functioning of God's altar. So if the fire would go out in the early morning before they restoked the fire, who cares? They didn't care. All right. So it's early in the morning in verse 4. Then the Lord called Samuel, and he answered, "Here I am." So he ran to Eli and said, "Here I am, for you called me." So the Lord calls Samuel. Samuel hears a call. He thinks it's Eli. He goes to Eli and he says, "Here I am." And Eli is asleep. Wakes him up out of a sound sleep and says, "Here I am, you called me." And Eli said, "I didn't call. Lie down, go back to bed." And the boy went and lay down. Then the Lord called yet again, "Samuel." So Samuel arose and went to Eli and said, "Here I am, you called me." And he answered, "I did not call, my son, lie down again." Now Samuel did not yet know the Lord, nor was the word of the Lord yet revealed to him. That is, as a prophet, Samuel did not know the Lord in that professional way. That an experienced prophet would recognize the voice of the Lord. It's not that he didn't have a relationship with God. Samuel turns out to be one of the greatest men of the Bible and one of the men that God loves dearly. So it's very likely that at this point he did have a relationship with God, but not yet as a prophet. You know, the relationship that develops between two people when it becomes intimate and you know the person by the sound of their voice. I could say to my wife, Cheryl, I could say, "Hun," and she would recognize that one syllable. If it was hushed, if it was whispered, if I was out of breath, "Honey," she knows it's me. And the prophet who fell in love with God and grew to know the Lord's voice, he would recognize the voice of the Lord. But Samuel did not yet know God's voice, and that will change soon. And so we see the practical problems that God has to deal with when he's working with people. Verse 8, "And the Lord called Samuel again the third time. Then he arose and went to Eli and said, 'Here I am, for you did call me.' Then Eli perceived that the Lord had called the boy." So Eli was more experienced and more in tune with God. And even though he didn't hear the voice, he understood what was happening. He was a good man, who loved the Lord, but he was an absolutely terrible father, and his children paid the price. I imagine that the times he lived in made it especially difficult for him to be a good dad. But I think he would agree that that was not an excuse, and that he should have been a better father, and he should have done a better job. After all, his kids, Eli's kids, right at this moment, right now, Eli is in heaven, his two sons are in hell. And if he had it to do over again, with what he knows now, he would have done a better job. But you never get it to do over again. Life is not a dress rehearsal. This is the real thing. Groundhog Day is just a movie, right? And even there, I think the point is made that getting to do it again and again and again backfires in even different ways. So Eli realized that something was up. This was not like this boy to act up or to act unreasonably. And Eli himself had heard no voice crying out, so he figures that Samuel is having a vision of the Lord. And being sensitive to the moving of the Spirit, he figured out that the call came from God. Verse 9. Therefore Eli said to Samuel, "Go, lie down, and it shall be, if he calls you, that you must say, 'Speak, Lord, for your servant hears.'" So Samuel went and lay down in his place. Now the Lord came and stood and called out, as at other times, "Samuel, Samuel." And Samuel answered, "Speak, for your servant hears." And I pray that I too will answer like Samuel did whenever the Lord calls me, and especially when I know it's the Lord calling. Because that's the time when we might say, "No, I didn't hear that." But with God's help, we will be ready to answer. Verse 11, "Then the Lord said to Samuel, 'Behold, I will do something in Israel at which both ears of everyone who hears it will tingle.'" Now, it's one thing to tingle somebody's ears. It's another to get both going at the same time. This has got to be a dramatic thing the Lord is planning. Verse 12, "In that day I will perform against Eli all that I have spoken concerning his house from beginning to end." And recall in the last chapter, a man of God came to Eli and warned him, saying, "Because of the wickedness of your sons, both of them, Hophni and Phinehas, will die in one day." And that was part of the prophecy against Eli's family. Verse 13, and here's the Lord speaking to Samuel still. "For I have told Eli that I will judge his house forever for the iniquity which he knows, because his sons made themselves vile, and he did not restrain them." His sons made themselves vile, and he did not restrain them. That is a condemnation of him as a father. And the punishment has come on the children even more so than on their dad. Today, it's increasingly hard to restrain your sons, or for that matter, anyone who's doing something wicked. In our family, if as our kids are growing up, if they do something wrong, we try to punish them and restrain them. Now, our government is trying to restrain us from restraining our kids. We have a restraining order put on us as parents that we're not allowed to spank our kids. Now, I've never been especially good at obeying the government. And so as to that particular demand from my life, I can't publicly say how well I've done or not. But I'd like us to look at some of the Bible verses regarding spanking and discipline. It's not something we've done in a study in quite a while. And of course, many of us here have young children. Some hope to have young children. Others have grandchildren. How should a parent administer a spanking? Is spanking the right way to discipline kids, to punish them and to train them? Well, the Bible speaks quite a bit about spanking. In fact, reading Psalm 118, not a typical spanking verse, but I picture God with Israel over his knee, really wailing away. Psalm 118 says, "The right hand of the Lord is exalted. The right hand of the Lord does valiantly." And I think he's spanking Israel right at that point, because the text says, "I shall not die but live, for the Lord has chastened me severely, but he has not given me over to death." Now note the parallel with that verse in Proverbs 23, verse 13. "Do not withhold correction from a child, for if you beat him with a rod, he will not die." That's pretty strong wording. That kind of wording, a typical spanking, where someone is spanked on the backside with whether it's a wooden spoon or a yardstick or a belt, a traditional spanking is considered, well, it's not only forbidden in general society today, but even among Christians that believe in spanking, they're afraid to use any of those words or describe any such spanking. They're just afraid to do it because how the culture will utterly condemn them and ridicule them and try to somehow shut them down if they promote spanking. And so our nation is against spanking, as we see suicide has become a leading cause of death of young people in America, and kids who have a terrible self-esteem and a lack of respect for their parents, their teachers, their elders, police officers and judges. And so much of that is a result of a lack of discipline. And kids decide when they will obey and when they will not. So Proverbs 23, "Do not withhold correction from a child. If you beat him with a rod," in other words, if you spank him, like with the switch, like kids used to go out to the woodshed and the father would say, "You go to the tree and pick your own switch off the tree." I don't know, I see some nods from some of the adults in the room who maybe remember that from when they were a kid. "And if you beat him with a rod, you will deliver his soul from hell." Proverbs 20, verse 30, "Blows that hurt cleanse away evil, as do stripes the inner depths of the heart." Blows that hurt. If you spank a child, now a younger child doesn't need to be spanked at all hardly, and sometimes a tap on the hand or flick a finger on the hand to teach, no, don't do that. Now, everybody loves to play with little babies. And you pick up a little baby, and once they start getting good at grabbing and all, the first thing they'll do is grab your glasses off you, maybe rip them and break them, scratch your eyeballs, and it's like dangerous. This kid is attacking me. And grandma comes to pick up the baby, and the baby goes, "Ah!" So what do? Well, Christians that have read the Bible and that have written books on the topic and that my wife and I have read, I've said, if the baby goes to grab your face or your glasses, just flick his finger with your hand. Say no. Always say the same thing every time. No. Flick his hand, you know, the soft part of his hand, and he will quickly learn not to do that. And it's so neat with Michael. Michael will pick him up. He spots the glasses. He goes for it. And I say, no. And he thinks better, and he puts his hands down. And he smiles, and I get to kiss him. And there's not a battle going on, and I don't have to put them down just for my own safety. But Proverbs 20:30, now as a child gets older, he could be spanked, like with a belt or a paddle on the backside. And it could hurt. In fact, if it doesn't hurt, it's probably going to be ineffective. Proverbs 20:30 says, "Blows that hurt cleanse away evil, as do stripes the inner depths of the heart." The King James Version there translated that, "The blueness of a wound cleanses away evil." Proverbs 10, verse 13, A rod is for the back of him who is devoid of understanding. And that's speaking of flogging a criminal. Flogging a criminal, the way they still do in plenty of places around the world today where they have almost no crime. But we would never flog a criminal. We let the criminals flog the women and children and the innocent victims. But we would never flog the criminal. Proverbs 13, verse 24. He who spares his rod hates his son. But he who loves him disciplines him promptly with the rod. See, there are various ways to train a child and to discipline a child, but the only way that God has authorized is not by timeouts. It's not by taking away the kid's VCR. It's by a spanking. I know a woman who was in the jury pool in my trial. I will not say who she was. But when we were asking the jurors about, because I spanked my stepson 6 years ago, 5 swats on the backside, and that's considered a crime in many places around the country, and hopefully you get away with it. If they catch you, they're going to really go after you. And we had how many trials? 3 or 4 trials, appeals. We won appeals, mistrials. Finally, they got me. But one of the jurors, in the jury pool, was asked about spanking, and she said, oh, I would never spank. I believe in timeout. In fact, I put myself in timeout. And when she said that, I knew she would not be a good juror for my case. And it turns out she's actually a friend of mine. I didn't know her at the time. But anyway, that's what we've come to. Parents are afraid to discipline their kids, and they punish themselves instead. Because what's a liberal to do? How are you supposed to get a child to obey if he doesn't want to obey? And we've gone around and around on this topic on the air with liberals who call in, public school teachers and parents. And, you know, you have a 13, 14-year-old girl who disobeys. And the parent doesn't believe in spanking. And they say, you have to be home at 10, and she comes home at midnight. And they say, well, you can't go out now for a week. And the next night, she doesn't come home from school. She comes home at 10 o'clock. And they say, you're grounded. And she just says, tough. They say, well, I'm locking you in your room. And she climbs out the window. What do? Put her in timeout? Not going to work. The child has already been lost. Because there's not a foundation of respect and honor for the parent. Because the child has always obeyed just when the child wanted to obey, not when the child did not want to obey. And that's where respect comes in, and obedience and honor. All right, a couple more verses. Proverbs 29, verse 15. The rod and reproof give wisdom, but a child left to himself brings shame to his mother. And Proverbs 22:15, foolishness is bound up in the heart of a child, but the rod of correction will drive it far from him. And also in the New Testament, we read in Hebrews 12, what son is there whom a father does not chasten? Now today, it's every other son. But back then, the typical son was spanked. Furthermore, Hebrews continues, we have had human fathers who corrected us and we paid them respect. Isn't that something? I treated my dad with respect, always, from when I first met him when I was a little kid until he passed away about 10 years ago. And he spanked me. If I was bad, he spanked me. I have a great love for him to this day. He became a Christian later in his life. He's with the Lord now. We had a wonderful relationship and total respect. I never told my dad to shut up. I never called him a name. I never raised a hand toward him, and he spanked me readily whenever the occasion deemed spanking was appropriate. All right. Now, let's get back to Samuel here. For this priest, Eli, had 2 very wicked sons, and he did nothing to restrain them. Verse 14, therefore, God says, I have sworn to the house of Eli that the iniquity of Eli's house shall not be atoned for by sacrifice or offering forever. In other words, eternal punishment in hell is what his sons are looking forward to. Now, if they repented at this point in time, there's every likelihood God would have forgiven them because God is great in mercy. But they did not repent. Verse 15. So Samuel lay down until morning. What a heavy burden to lay on a young, brand new prophet. Here's his master, Eli, probably the high priest at the time, and Samuel is his servant. He's Samuel's mentor. And the first prophecy he gets from the Lord is, your boss's kids are going to be killed. Wow, that's pretty rough. That's a burden to bear. And that's why we saw when we studied the prophet Nahum, it says the burden of Nahum concerning Nineveh. It's a burden to get a prophecy like this from the Lord. And so Samuel lay down until morning and opened the doors of the house of the Lord. And Samuel was afraid to tell Eli the vision. Then Eli called Samuel and said, Samuel, my son. And he answered, here I am. Samuel, now, he was the son that Eli always wished he had had. Eli had two sons, but they were a disgrace to him. And here was Samuel, whom he raised from a young child. And he said, what is the word that the Lord spoke to you? Please do not hide it from me. God do so to you and much more also if you hide anything from me of all the things that he said to you. That's somewhat rough on the kid. But not only that, notice how Eli knew it was bad news. He just knew it was bad news. Verse 18, then Samuel told him everything and hid nothing from him. And Eli said, it is the Lord. Let him do what seems good to him. Well, Eli here is humble, accepting the Lord's judgment. Perhaps he took that message and went and passionately pled with his sons to repent and told them what God had said. But somehow, I get the sense from the text that he didn't do that. That at this point, he had given up on his children. And that's one thing James Dobson says we must never do, is give up on our kids. As long as there's life, there's hope. If someone has gone astray, there's a chance to turn them around. That doesn't mean that we should not employ tough love. Of course, we should, and sometimes with our children.